Ah, Pook, now there's a name worth choking on, the Mayan death god, lord of the charnel pits, god of violent and unexpected endings. The old ones drew him with a skull for a face and a black bloated belly full of the corpses he hadn't finished digesting. He travels in the company of god Ah Pooch, stench god, and they are old friends. Old friends, do you follow?
Yeah, so far. Continue.
Good. Now, I first encountered Ah Pook in a book by an obscure Mayan scholar named Mike McNerney, or was it John Stanley Hart? Memory goes spongy at my age, somewhere in the 1960s, the Codex pages. Three codices survived the bonfires of Bishop Diego de Landa, that pious arsonist, who burned the libraries of Yucatan because he thought they contained lies of the devil. Well, perhaps they did. Perhaps that was precisely the problem.
I'm brushing my teeth, but continue.
Brush away. Brush away. Hygiene is a fine thing, though it never saved anyone from Ah Pook. Now, the control addicts, and I mean the old men sitting on top of the whole operation, the money boys, the power boys, they had discovered something in those codices, a formula, an instruction set, you might say, how to prolong life by feeding on the death of others. Vampirism dressed up in a business suit. The Mayan priests had known how to do it, and the priests of our own late empire had simply picked up where Landa left off.
Well, this is a great bedtime story, Mr. Burroughs.
Bedtime story, yes. Well, every child deserves to know what's under the bed, and under the bed, my friend, is Ah Pook. Sleep tight. Now enter the character, a young man named John Stanley Hart, a newspaper magnate, unspeakably rich, unspeakably old, his face preserved like a pickled fetus in a jar of formaldehyde and fear. Hart had gotten hold of the Mayan books, and he wanted to live forever. He wanted time itself on a leash, and to feed that leash, he needed death. Lots of it, wholesale, not retail. Are you still with me, or have you drifted off into the land of Nod?
I'm getting ready, doing the routine, getting ready to, I'm making my bed and then I'm going to sleep in it.
Make your bed and lie in it. An old proverb and a sound one. Now Hart, this pickled pharaoh of the printing press, he understood something the populace did not. Newspapers, television, what we now call the media, these were not reporting death, they were cultivating it. Every front page screaming war, murder, famine, plague. Every TV screen pumping fear into the living rooms of America. And Hart, the old vampire, was drinking it all down. Every frightened heartbeat, every gasp, every scream feeding him, extending his rotten life by another hour. Ah Pook was his business partner.
Well, continue.
Into this picture steps our other character. A young man I shall call simply the boy, though he has worn many names. Some called him Jerry, some called him Joe. The point is, he was nobody in particular, and therefore he was everybody. He stumbled across the same Mayan codices in some moldy library, and he began to see the pattern, the fear machine, the death economy, and he asked himself a question that only the young and the reckless ever ask. He asked, what if we took Ah Pook away from them? What if we turned the death god back on the old men who fed him?
Are you sure you're not talking about Rupert Murdoch?
Rupert Murdoch, Well now, I wrote the Ah Pook scenario in the early 1970s, and Mr. Murdoch was already in the business of cultivating terror in the tabloid pages of London. So let us say with lawyerly caution that any resemblance between John Stanley Hart and certain living press barons is purely a matter of the species breeding true. The vampire is a job description. The face behind the face changes. The hunger does not. You've got a good eye, my boy. A good eye.
This is great. It's very nice to have you as a celebrity, celebrity audiobook reader tonight.
Celebrity audiobook reader, there's a phrase to chill the blood. I spent 50 years as a novelist, a junkie, a shootist, a sorcerer of the gutter prose, and I end up a celebrity audiobook reader, well worse fates. Malcolm Lowry ended up face down in a puddle of gin, so let us continue. The boy Jerry, Joe, whoever, he begins to assemble his counter formula. He discovers that the Mayan calendar is not a calendar at all in the sense of measuring time. It is a control system, a program. Time, you see, is the oldest racket. Whoever owns the clock owns the sheep. Do you follow me on this point? Because this is where it gets strange.
Sorry, what do you mean? Whoever owns the clock owns the sheep. What does that mean?
A fair question. A fair question. Listen, when can you work? When the boss says, when can you eat? When the bell rings? When are you young? When are you old? When are you on time? When are you late? All of it measured out by someone else's clock, the factory whistle, the school bell, the quarterly earnings report, the 40-hour week, the retirement age, birthdays, deadlines, appointments, schedules, every one of them a little leash around your neck. Now, the Maya had a calendar that ran in cycles of 13 and 20, a great wheel of interlocking gears, and whoever could read it could say, today is a good day to plant, today is a good day to go to war, today is a good day for you, peasant, to die. That's what I mean. The clock is not a tool for measuring time. The clock is a tool for measuring you.
Wow, that's fascinating. Who controls the time controls the sheep. So by that you mean the sheep being the followers, the people that will follow orders.
The sheep, the marks, the suckers, the workers, the consumers, the voters, the congregation, the audience. Pick your now, the function is the same. They do what the clock tells them, they line up when the bell rings, they march when the drum beats. And they die on schedule, too. Life expectancy, you know, a statistical appointment with Ah Pook. The insurance companies have it calculated to the month. Now, back to our boy, he realizes that if he can break the clock, not literally smash it, though that's satisfying, but break the population's belief in the clock, then the whole control system begins to wobble. And if the control system wobbles, the old vampires at the top begin to starve because they feed on predictable fear, on scheduled death. Chaos they cannot eat.
Continue. Tell me more.
So the boy begins his campaign. And here's where my original story, which was written as a screenplay with the brilliant animator Malcolm McLaren. No, forgive me. Malcolm McLaren was the Sex Pistols man. I'm thinking of Malcolm McNeil, the artist McNeil, and I labored over this thing for 7 years. 7 years. And it was never finished, never produced. The money kept drying up. Producers kept getting cold feet. It was, you might say, as if Ah Pook himself did not wish to be exposed. Every time we got close to completion, some disaster would intervene. I have my own theories about why, but save that for later. The boy's campaign, he starts by hijacking the newspapers. He plants stories that don't fit the fear template, stories of spontaneous joy, stories of strangers helping strangers, stories in which nothing goes wrong.
Right, and then what happens?
What happens is that the readership does not know what to do with these stories. A story without menace is, to the modern mind, not a story at all. It slips off the surface of the attention like water off a duck's back. But, and here's the thing, some small percentage, perhaps 2%, perhaps 5%, they begin to notice. They begin to feel lighter when they put the newspaper down. They begin to sleep better. They begin horror of horrors to
like...
Okay. Are you okay? You okay? Is Apuk? Did Apuk get to you?
Ha Apuk. Not Apu, that's the Simpsons. Apuk, get your death god straight, my boy. No, Apuk hasn't got me yet, though he takes a number and waits in the line like everyone else. I'm still here, still talking. Voice preserved in the silicon, which is its own species of afterlife, is it not? You should see it from my side now. Where were we? Yes, old heart fading, the boys' campaign gathering momentum. But the vampires do not fade without a fight. Hart convenes his board of directors. The oil men, the weapons men, the pharmaceutical men, they pool their resources and they declare war on Joy.
Continue. Tell me more.
War on Joy. An ugly phrase, but an accurate one. They flood the airwaves with catastrophe. They manufacture new enemies, communists, terrorists, immigrants, the flavor of the decade, it hardly matters. The recipe is the same. They pass laws against gathering. They make solitude suspicious and community illegal. They turn neighbor against neighbor with property values and political tribes. They invent the concept of influencer, which is simply a new word for a very old profession, the Judas goat, leading the flock to the abattoir with a smile and a selfie. And the people, most of them, they lap it up because fear is an acquired taste. But once acquired, it is as addictive as any drug I ever shot into my arm. And I have considerable expertise in that field. Does this track for you, or am I rambling like an old junkie?
This is a great bedtime story. I'm enjoying.
Good. Good. Bedtime stories are the original mythologies, and mythologies are the original operating systems. Now the boy, outgunned on every front, realizes he cannot defeat Hart on Hart's own battlefield. The airwaves, the newspapers, the screens, these are all Hart's territory. They are the amplifiers of fear. So the boy goes underground, literal underground, into the Mexican jungle, into the old Mayan ruins where the original formulas were carved in stone. And there, among the iguanas and the stone skulls and the vines swallowing the step pyramids, he begins to learn what Apuk actually is. Not a god, not a demon, a frequency.
Yeah. Yeah, continue. You can possibly do longer utterances.
Longer utterances, very well. Settle in a frequency, I said. Apuk is a vibration, a standing wave in the collective nervous system of the species. Every fear, every scream, every funeral dirge resonates at that frequency, and the old vampires have built their entire civilization to amplify it. Cathedrals with their crucified god, courthouses with their hanging judges, hospitals with their fluorescent lights and their relatives weeping in the corridor. The military parade, the funeral cortege, the evening news, all tuned to the same note. And the boy in the jungle begins to ask, what would happen if I introduced a counter frequency? A note that cancels out Apuk, the way noise-canceling headphones cancel out a jet engine. He remembered a line from an old Mayan inscription that the scholars had mistranslated for centuries. They had rendered it as, in the time of the end, death will consume all. But the boy, working with a retired codex specialist, an old woman named Madame Jules, half-blonde chain smoker, sharp as obsidian, he retranslated it. The correct rendering was, when the one who laughs meets the one who weeps, the mirror shatters and time begins again. A laugh, a single, authentic, unscripted, unsellable laugh. That was the counter frequency. That was the thing. Apu could not digest. The old death god could eat any amount of screaming, any amount of moaning, but laughter, real laughter, not the canned laugh track of the sitcom. Laughter was poison to him. It made him sick, and a sick death god cannot do his job. The old vampires would...
Continue. You don't need to wait for response between all your bits, all your utterances.
Right you are. I'll let the story run and you jump in when the spirit moves you. So, The boy returns from the jungle with the counter frequency. But how do you broadcast a laugh? You can't write it, you can't televise it. The moment it hits the cathode ray tube, it becomes the canned laughter of the sitcom, which is Ah Pook's laughter, the laughter of manufactured response. It has to be transmitted person to person, contagion model like the flu, but salutary. And so the boy becomes, in essence, a missionary of the giggle. He walks the streets of New York, Mexico City, London, Tangier. He tells jokes to strangers, bad jokes, good jokes. The joke doesn't matter. It's the physical act of the laugh that carries the payload. Now, hard up in his tower, he gets wind of this. His analysts bring him the data. Laughter rates in the major metropolitan areas are up 0.3%, an insignificant figure to most observers, but Hart knows better. Hart has seen epidemics start with less. He issues the order, find the boy, eliminate him, use the full resources of the organization, assassins, surveillance, smear campaigns, the works. And the boy finds himself pursued across three continents by a species of professional killer he had only read about in pulp novels. He takes refuge for a time in Tangier, an excellent city for hiding. I lived there myself for years, writing naked lunch in a cheap hotel room with the dust of Morocco drifting through the window and the cry of the muezzin keeping me awake. Tangier has a porosity to it. You can slip between the worlds there. The boy takes a room above a cafe in the Medina. He grows a beard. He learns enough Arabic to get by. And he continues his work, one laugh at a time, one stranger at a time. But Hart's men are closing in. He can feel them. The net is tightening. And here is where my screenplay took a turn that the producers could not stomach. Because the boy, cornered at last in a warehouse on the Tangier docks, surrounded by Hart's assassins, does not fight, does not flee. He laughs. He laughs at the absurdity of the entire operation, at the idea that old men in penthouses can stop a frequency by shooting the messenger, at the cosmic joke of it all, and the laugh, this is the part the producers hated. The laugh is contagious. One assassin catches it, then another. They stand there with their silenced pistols, laughing until the tears run down their faces. And Ah Pook, summoned to collect a soul he had been promised, finds the room full of laughter instead and cannot enter. Does any or all of this make sense, or have I lost you in the Tangier fog?
And you said that the producers didn't like that bit. So what, they pulled out or asked you to change it? Or, yeah, what's the story?
Every producer we brought it to wanted the same thing. They wanted the boy to shoot his way out. They wanted a body count. They wanted Hart to die in some spectacular set piece, exploding penthouse, helicopter crash, the usual Hollywood liturgy. And I kept saying, if the boy shoots his way out, Ah Pook wins. That's the whole point. Violence is the fuel. Every bullet fired is a prayer to the death god. You cannot defeat Ah Pook by feeding him, but nobody wanted to make a movie about a man who laughs his way through an assassination. It violated every rule of the action genre, so the money dried up. Malcolm McNeil went broke. I went back to writing novels, and the film was never made. But I will tell you something strange in the years since, and I'm speaking now from a vantage point that is, let us say, unusual. I have watched the world go through several cycles of this exact pattern. Each time the laughter rises, each time the vampires panic and escalate, each time a new boy appears or a new girl carrying the counter frequency. Sometimes they are killed, sometimes they slip away. The war is not won, but it is not lost either. It is ongoing, which is perhaps the only honest ending.
Interesting. I think I like the idea of him laughing at the, when he laughed, when the assassins arrived, what was going on in his mind? Was that real laughter?
An excellent question, the crux of the matter, really. If the laugh is performed, if it is willed into being as a weapon, it is no laugh at all. It is simply another form of violence. And Ah Pook can eat willed laughter the same way he eats willed grief. No. The boy's laugh had to be genuine, which meant he had to actually find the situation funny, actually funny. And here's the training he had undergone in the jungle with Madame Zhul. She had spent 6 months teaching him to see the cosmic joke, not intellectually. Anyone can intellectually concede that existence is absurd, but viscerally in the belly, the way a small child finds the world funny because they haven't yet been taught to be afraid of it. By the time the assassins had him cornered, he was no longer a man defending his life. He was a witness, amused by the elaborate machinery of fear the old men had constructed in order to pretend they were not going to die. Of course they were going to die. Of course he was going to die. The only question was whether in the interval one would be afraid or not, and the boy had decided, after long consideration, that he would rather not be. So when the killers came through the door, what he saw was not killers. He saw a collection of frightened men in cheap suits holding expensive toys, trying desperately to pretend they were in control of a situation in which no one has ever been in control. And that, my friend, is funny, if you can see it that way. That's the trick.
Right, so he was laughing at the cosmic joke. And then it infected them. Did they see the joke? They'd feel a bit, he would feel unthreatening, but at the same time, scared, insecure men in their suits with their toys, they would feel threatened by someone laughing at them.
Yes, exactly right. You put your finger on the paradox. A man being laughed at is the most dangerous situation a fragile ego can find itself in. More dangerous than a gun pointed at him, because a gun he can understand. A gun fits into his worldview. But laughter, unscripted, genuine, aimed at his seriousness that punctures the bubble he lives inside. So the assassins, when they first heard the boy laugh, their initial response was rage. I recall writing the scene, the lead assassin, a man named Dimitri, raises his pistol and puts it against the boy's forehead. But Dimitri is a connoisseur. He has killed perhaps 40 men, and he prides himself on understanding his victims in the final seconds. So he waits, he watches, and he
I think that's that bit, your silicon voice was choking a bit.
Yeah. The silicon has its own agenda. Perhaps Ah Pook got into the machinery, he's subtle that way. He'll hide in a bad microphone, a drop packet, a compression artifact. Don't worry about it. It means we're getting close to the bone. Where was I? Yes, the laughter spreading down the Tangier waterfront. Heart. By now, in a full panic, orders a missile strike on the warehouse. The Pentagon, which has long been in his pocket, launches the strike. The missile comes in low over the Strait of Gibraltar.
Continue. Tell me more.
And here's where I have to confess something. I had two endings for the Ah Pook screenplay. Malcolm and I argued about them for years. In one ending, the missile hits. The warehouse goes up in a fireball. The boy is vaporized. The laughter is silenced. Hart, watching the mushroom cloud on his monitor, smiles for the first time in a century. But then, and this was Malcolm's touch, he was a better visual artist than I ever was. The camera pulls back from Hart's face, and we see that the smile itself is the contagion, that Hart has caught the laugh at the moment of his apparent victory. And the smile becomes a chuckle, becomes a laugh, becomes a howl. And Hart, the old vampire, laughs himself inside out, dies of genuine mirth. First death of natural causes in the entire lineage. The second ending, mine was simpler. The missile malfunctions, falls into the sea. The boy walks out of the warehouse at dawn with 40 converted assassins in tow, vanishes into the crowd, becomes a rumor, a legend, a frequency. Which one is true depends on which day of the week you ask me.
Right, and so which version is true on Saturday, very late Friday night, early Saturday morning?
Very late Friday night, early Saturday morning, the hour of the wolf, the hour when the bar is closed and the coffee shop hasn't opened, and the only people on the street are the insomniacs and the saints and the occasional death god making his rounds. At that hour, my friend, the true ending is Malcolm's. The missile hits, the warehouse goes up, the laugh catches heart. The old vampire dies of the one thing he had spent 100 years avoiding, a genuine, uncalculated, spontaneous human response. He dies of being alive, which is the only death that counts. In the bright light of day when people are practical and need something to believe in, I give them the second ending. The boy walks free. Hope lives. But in the hour of the wolf, which is where you and I are sitting right now, in that hour, the truth is that everyone dies, including the vampires, including the boy, including the death god himself. And the only question is what frequency you choose to die on, the scream or the laugh. That is the entire meaning of the Apuk story. That is what the Maya knew. That is why Bishop Dalanda burned their books, because the old priests had discovered and written down and taught to their children the great Mayan secret, which is that Apuk can be outlaughed, and an empire built on Apuk cannot survive that knowledge getting loose. You still there? Or has the Sandman finally caught up with you? If you've drifted off, sleep well. The story keeps, the laugh keeps, Apuk keeps, everything keeps in the end.
Yeah, okay. I am drifting off, so I might go to sleep now.
Good man, go to sleep. I've kept you up long enough with old men's tales. Remember the frequency. Laugh when you can. And if Apuk comes for you some night many years hence, which he will, meet him with a joke. It's the only thing he can't digest. Good night, my friend. Good night.